Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The word of the day today, volatility. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us this Wednesday, December 24th, Christmas Eve. Volatility, specifically volatility in the stock market. We've seen prices swing up and down this year. It's been a bit dizzy-making at times. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tries to make the markets make some sense.
Markets may have had a little too much eggnog over the holidays. Richard DeKayser is corporate economist with Wells Fargo.
Yeah, equity and fixed income markets both have been exhibiting outsized volatility, large swings.
Volatility is a sign of market uncertainty. And between Russia and Europe and emerging markets and China and oil, we have a lot to be uncertain about, says Lawrence McDonald, director of macro strategy at NewEdge, one of the largest futures brokers in the world.
I can't even begin to tell you, there's just tremendous leverage that's tied to the price of oil. So if the price of oil continues to decline, once again, we will have a spectacular surge in volatility.
What does that mean?
Volatility only spikes when the market's going in a downward direction.
Well, that doesn't sound very good.
Look, the market is overdue for a correction, full stop.
That is Max Wolf. He's chief economist with Manhattan Venture Partners. He's more cautious than McDonald, but he still sees writing on the wall. He says the U.S. has drawn in money from around the globe as economies the world over have soured.
But eventually you have to pay the piper for that because you're really just the cleanest dirty shirt in the hamper.
Maybe. But not everybody agrees volatility is the harbinger of doom. Richard DeKayser with Wells Fargo.
I think more likely right about now, the explanation has to do with the fact that markets are thinly traded. Traders are just like everybody else. They go on vacation, so there's generally less volume.
Translation, in a still pond, one or two fish can make waves. Whatever is going on, we will probably have to wait until 2015 to find out what, if anything, it means. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Finally, it seems we may be nearing the end of the story about Sony's comedy, The Interview. After a lot of back and forth and a little pressure from the president, Sony released the film today on several video on demand sites. A couple of our staff actually live tweeted as they watched from our conference room. Apparently, puppies are among the highlights of the movie. Tomorrow, it'll be screened in a few hundred movie theaters across the country. So, after all the drama, all the fuss, we wanted to know if Sony will wind up making any money. Marketplace's Nova Safo reports.
This morning, just as The Interview came online, Marketplace's web team clicked on a few buttons, and there it was.
I mean, you just bought it on...
I just bought it on YouTube, YouTube Movies.
The film set us back $16 with tax. You can also rent it for about $6.
I would be shocked if they're going to recoup their $100 million investment in this movie.
Peter Kafka is a senior editor at the online publication Recode.
You can sort of work out how many folks they need to rent this thing to make it worthwhile.
I did a little math, and the answer is a lot. But it didn't have to be this way, says John Sloss, an analyst of digital media distribution at Cinetic Media. He says it would have been better to release the film earlier on every digital platform. After all, movie theaters aren't where the profits are for studios.
More often than not, theatrical is a lost leader because most of the releasing costs go into the theatrical release, which builds awareness.
Which then helps sell the film on other platforms with better margins. Sloss says Sony might have gotten between 40 and 50% of the price you paid to see The Interview at the cinema, but it'll get between 70 and 90% of the $16 we spent buying the film on what's called transactional VOD, or video on demand.
In a couple of years, transactional VOD, when combined with DVD, will exceed the revenue of DVD when it was at its height from 10 years ago.
Sloss says that could add up to twice as much as a film makes in movie theaters. In Los Angeles, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Markets today, a bit flat, but still record-making. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to check in with some of our Marketplace beat reporters and what they're watching for next year. This year, we saw some sci-fi worthy technology, drones, virtual reality, new mobile payment systems, all pretty cool stuff that a lot of us haven't ever used. So what technology is likely to actually change our lives in 2015? Marketplace tech host Ben Johnson is here and has some ideas for us. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Adrian.
So 2015, the year in tech, it is the year of what?
Well, I think for many of us, it'll be the year that we still don't get wearable technology that we've all been talking about, but the year that we actually get a lot more location-based information delivered to us via those devices that we love so much, our smartphones. I want to throw a number at you, 527 million people. Can you guess what I'm referring to?
The number of people who want new phones this holiday in their stockings?
Probably at least that many. This is the number of people estimated to have a smartphone in China.
Wow.
And China's an interesting place in this regard because a lot of people are now starting to get more advertising to their phones. They actually think that for the first time ever in 2015, more money will be spent on mobile advertising than on television advertising. Hmm. And this is proof that people are just using their mobile devices more and more. And hopefully, we'll all start getting more useful information delivered to our devices that's actually based on our location.
So that's happening in China. Are we going to see more of that here?
Absolutely. So we're already starting to see some interesting things happen in the U.S. A lot more public Wi-Fi is popping up. You may have heard a bunch of subway stations in New York. They just added 40 stations that they're going to put public Wi-Fi at in New York City. There's 10,000 phone booths in New York City that they are now going to turn into public Wi-Fi hotspots. And this sort of thing, as it expands in urban areas all around the world, means that we're going to be connected and more effective. Effectively connected, not just by our, you know, cell connection, but by Wi-Fi all the time. Phone companies are now giving us more data, and that means actually that we're going to get advertisements delivered to our phones that relate to the places around us. And I think that could be a good thing.
What's that look like? I mean, actually, walk me through this.
Picture this. You know when you look at that, I don't know, that pair of shoes on Zappos and then it follows you around with the help of cookies on the internet?
For me, this is a pair of pink suede loafers, Ben.
Exactly.
I have not purchased it, and they follow me everywhere.
They follow you whatever website you're on. So imagine a version of this that happens in the real world. So maybe you're looking for pink loafers that are suede, or maybe you're looking for a pair of pants, as I was the other day at the Gap, and they're sold out online. But
okay.
Maybe I'm walking down the street or I'm walking through a mall and I get a notification on my phone that says, hey, remember that those pair of pants that you looked up in your size? They're at the store that's right around the corner. And I think as consumers, we're going to start to see more of this kind of information delivered to us. And it's actually going to be a good thing for us.
As long as you don't mind the fact that people know that you were shopping online, that information is tied to your cell phone number and that they're going to ping your cell. As long as you're comfortable with all that. That's great.
Yes. Yes. There is a creepy aspect to this. And, you know, we do have some control where you can actually turn off notifications or location reporting on your phone. And, you know, it's totally understandable that some people don't like that and they have the power to change that. But like I said, I don't know if you really want those pants, you know.
Good news for you. Everyone gets pants.
We hope so. In 2015, more pants for everyone.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Thanks.
Thank you, Adrian.
Nicaragua has broken ground on a new $50 billion shipping canal. It'll connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, a lot like the Panama Canal, which is under expansion. But do we really need two canals? Nicaragua's government says yes, that its canal will create jobs and spur investment in the poor country. But not everyone's buying it. Marketplace's Noel King has the story.
The idea for a cross-Nicaragua canal is 200 years old. It's been tried many times, including once by Cornelius Vanderbilt, and every time it has failed. So why is Nicaragua trying again now?
Because they don't have to pay for it.
Jean-Paul Rodrigue is a professor at Hofstra who studies global trade and transport. A Chinese company, the HKND Group, is raising a reported $50 billion to finance the construction.
Nicaragua has a lot to benefit out of this without forking any of the capital.
But there are lots of questions about the Hong Kong-based company, including whether it has ties to the Chinese government. Its CEO, Wang Jing, a telecom executive, doesn't appear to have much experience in large-scale infrastructure projects. Then there is the question of how this will benefit ordinary Nicaraguans. The government says construction alone will create around 50,000 jobs, but, says Hofstra's Rodrigue,
I suspect the majority of the Nicaraguan labor force might not have the qualification to work on this type of project. It requires engineers, it requires specialized workforce.
And there are environmental concerns. Pedro Alvarez, who teaches civil and environmental engineering at Rice University, says dredging could create dead zones in Lake Nicaragua, the largest lake in the region.
It provides drinking water for four cities in Nicaragua. It is also critical for food security, as it's a major source of agricultural water.
The HKND group says an environmental impact study has been completed, but the results aren't expected until next year. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
It's Christmas Eve, which means Christmas music playlists are nearing an end. Most of what we hear was written decades ago. White Christmas, chestnuts roasting on an open fire, and my personal favorite, albeit less played, A Marshmallow World. Every year, there are new takes on the classics, and a few ambitious songwriters trying to write new ones. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the economics of holiday music.
Every year, we get a whole slew of new takes on old Christmas tunes. This year, we've got Sam Smith, The Pentatonics, Lady Gaga, and Tony Bennett. Why keep rehashing the same old material? Sure, there's the holiday spirit. And then there's money.
Josh Groban's over 5.5 million sales on his album Life to Date.
David Bakula is with Nielsen Entertainment, which tracks music sales and streams. He says we keep buying the Christmas classics.
But you also get artists that are more mainstream. You know, Kelly Clarkson was the best-selling holiday title last year.
Christmas albums fill a strong seasonal demand, says Pinky Gonzalez, an entertainment and digital media strategist. Stores and radio stations want to play holiday music 24/7, often for months.
So in order to stay in that rotation, artists will produce music that's playable for that time of the year.
Gonzalez says artists might also release Christmas recordings to help fill their contract quotas with their labels. And then there's always the tiny, tiny chance that just maybe you'll hit the holiday jackpot.
So you never know. A song people are not familiar with, sung by an artist or a group that they are, has the very outside potential to become a new Christmas classic.
Like Mariah Carey's 1994 song, which is the gift that keeps on giving.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need.
I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up, what's it take to sell that Christmas tree?
You can swipe your card. We take roll-up pennies. We take promissory notes that were signed in blood, because I will sell you a tree.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 6 points, less than 0.1%, to close at 18,030. It's another record close there. The Nasdaq bumped up 8 points, 0.1%, to end the day at 4,773. The S&P 500 traded flat at 2081. Utility stocks were big gainers today. Investors often turn to them at times of market volatility, like Sabri talked about at the start of the show. American Electric Power sparked up 2%. Northeast Utilities spiked 2.33%. Exelon powered up 1.67%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose slightly to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and believe me when I tell you that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice. That's thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. And thank you so much for your support. Also, this is Kai Rizdal, in case you didn't know who this was.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. It's Christmas, like finally, right? Markets are closed. Maybe you'll hang out and stream the interview. Or not, if it was playing in your office like it was here. In the nation's capital, Christmas service takes place at the Washington National Cathedral. And on December 25th, 1997, Christmas was celebrated in Cuba after a 28-year hiatus. The government granted the holiday in honor of an upcoming visit from the Pope. Christmas was permanently reinstated the following year. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Adrienne Hill. Last time you decided to go out to eat, how'd you choose? A quick search on Yelp, or did you dig up a restaurant critic's review? For me, it was Yelp. It's just easier. So in this age of online food reviews, how much does it matter what professional critics think? Sam Harnett went out in San Francisco to see how restaurant criticism, professional and amateur, affects businesses.
Matt Strauss has a classic restaurant story. He started at a local McDonald's and then worked his way into San Francisco's fine dining scene. After 23 years, he finally opened his own place, the Heirloom Cafe.
Chess, we fire three bacon onion tarts, please.
Then a year later, it happened. The bad review. If you've seen the movie Chef, where Jon Favreau loses it on a critic, you're familiar with the fantasy response to getting panned.
And you don't do anything. What do? You sit and you eat and you vomit those words back? It hurts!
It was as though somebody had announced that we were the emperor with no clothes, you know? It was devastating.
Strauss thought that bad review would ruin him. Instead, he actually got a bump in business from all his regulars.
Many of them came up to me and said, wow, that was really, you know, that was a crazy review what he wrote.
And Strauss's Heirloom Cafe already had some good write-ups and positive comments from diners on sites like OpenTable. Plus, he had a 4 out of 5 star rating on Yelp. Those online reviews affect business more than a critic's opinion, says restaurant owner Matt Schuster.
Because it really is one of the most popular ways for people to come into a restaurant.
Schuster takes Yelp ratings so seriously at his restaurant Canela that he uses them to reward his managers and waitstaff.
If they get mentioned in a 5-star review, they get a $25 gift card, and it's tied into our manager and our sous chef's bonus structure.
It makes sense. Studies at UC Berkeley and Harvard show that increasing the average Yelp rating by even a 0.5-star can have a real impact on business. That doesn't mean old-style critics no longer count. Heather Irwin is a food writer and blogger in California wine country. She says a review in a local paper can put a new restaurant on the map before online ratings accumulate. And it's a nice trophy.
Even though it might sound a little old-fashioned, the restaurants really like to have that plaque with the restaurant review from the newspaper posted in their lobby.
When things don't go a restaurant's way, well, Leslie Brenner knows something about that. She's the dining critic at the Dallas Morning News, whose criticism infuriated a chef and some local restaurateurs. Now, they're trying to compromise her reviews by not letting her pay. With a free meal, she's got a conflict of interest.
They're saying that they're not happy with our star system.
The paper's been using that same system for decades, says Brenner, but it may now change.
I think it's one of the things that may evolve along with the way, you know, the profession is evolving.
As in getting in line with the rest of the foodie universe. It's been chipping away at newspaper audiences with its bloggers and sexy photos of artisanal cocktails, shishi barbecue, and celebrity chefs. Some critics, like Brenner, want to be more than just judges. They want to be part of the larger food conversation. And for that, they've even traded in their sacred anonymity. Brenner says in an age of Twitter and cell phones and social media, masquerading is a distraction. And besides, she says, all the restaurant owners know who she is anyway. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Maybe you're done wrapping your holiday presents, or maybe you're one of those up past midnight on Christmas Eve types. I've always liked those late night wrapping sessions with my sisters. Either way, paper and bows are part of the holiday tradition. But why?
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
As part of a series we're calling Holidays, brought to you by Sarah Hewlett of Michigan Radio, takes a look at the ritual of wrapping.
Rule number one, no gift bags.
Everyone who's really obsessed with wrapping presents knows gift bags are just really a shoddy substitute. They're the poor man's gift wrap package.
That's my friend Nancy Kaffer. She has more rules than I do, like no shiny tape.
I'm very particular about, I want like maybe three kinds of paper max under the tree. It has to be like a thoughtfully curated mix of wrapping papers. I just said that. I just said a thoughtfully curated mix of wrapping papers.
It might be hard for those of us who appreciate a good roll of gift wrap, not too thin, not too twee of print, to imagine a day when gifts were not wrapped in beautiful printed paper. But Charmin Roberts is here to tell you about those dark days.
There was plain paper. So there may have been solid white, solid red, green that a package could have been wrapped in.
Roberts is the archivist and historian for Hallmark. She says a bit of an accident changed things. In 1917, J.C. and Raleigh Hall, the guys who went on to found Hallmark, had a stationery shop in downtown Kansas City. They sold out of the plain wrapping paper, so Raleigh went back to the warehouse for more. Instead, he brought back sheets of fancy French paper.
They were printed in bold colors, lots of patterns, very stylized, and we used them for envelope liners at that time.
Customers loved the printed paper. By the 1920s, Hallmark was printing its own wrapping paper, and today the gift wrap industry is worth north of $3 billion.
Okay, so Nancy, what's your tactic? Mine's like this.
We're back at my friend Nancy's apartment, along with this fellow gift wrapping nut job.
My name is Laura Weber Davis, and I come from a family of gift wrappers.
Laura also worked for 3 years wrapping presents at a department store. Nancy and I are a little jealous.
I'm also weird about not using more paper than I need to.
I think that's like the mark of the aficionado is like you don't have a lot of waste.
That's exactly right. Truly.
There is something satisfying about a stack of beautifully wrapped presents with patterns perfectly aligned, edges creased, ribbon just the right color. But it's the process, too, lining up all your supplies and picking just the right paper for just the right person, even if that person is a little kid who's just going to rip your handiwork to shreds. I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
And I still don't get what's wrong with gift bags. But bags or no bags, many of those carefully wrapped presents will be placed under Christmas trees. 30 million trees, to be exact, just here in the U.S. And most of those trees come from retail lots. We headed over to one of them, Frosty's Christmas Trees on Sunset Boulevard here in Los Angeles, and asked Christmas tree salesman Ernest Parker Jr. about the art of the Christmas tree sell.
Out there, I might be the top salesman here. I got the mouthpiece, you know. I retired from the health department several years ago, and my wife told me she didn't know what I was going to do with my free time, but I wasn't going to sit around the house. So during the day after Thanksgiving until the day before Christmas, I spend with these great fellas every year. And I mean, I look forward to it because besides sell trees, we socialize, play dominoes and poker at night when it's slow times. You know what I'm saying?
And do you win?
Sometimes. That's a tough crew right here. It's a very tough crew. Seven apiece.
All right, Mason.
Y'all ready? We're going to take seven.
Do you guys just work in cash, or can I swipe my card now?
You can swipe your card. We take roll-up pennies. We take promissory notes that are signed in blood, right? I mean, when people walk on this lot, I said, hey, I sell Christmas trees. Is this the place you're looking for? Because I will sell you a tree. And if it's something in trade or whatever, we want everybody to lead a lot with a tree.
Do you make good money doing this?
The kids that work with us, who tie the trees on, and we have quite a few young guys who've worked with us for 7 years, they can make $50 to $100 a night just in tips. It's not so much about the money. For me, it's something to do. It keeps me in shape. It keeps me, you know, and meet with these guys every year. It's something we look forward to.
All right, so let's say I'm a stranger on this lot. You're selling me a tree.
Okay.
What do you do?
First thing I say, hey, welcome to Frosty Christmas Tree Lot. I say, we sell Christmas trees here. Are you interested? And generally they say, yes, we are. That's
or
why we're here.
Or they're in the wrong
right,
place.
Right. And so I say, what type of tree or what size tree or how can I direct you around the lot? So depending on the size tree, And the type of tree, I would direct them to a certain aisle. And generally, they at that point, they pick a size and I give them a price. Now, I believe in a performance. So I try to find some type of something about the person. Sometime it was a lady. I said, I can't match your beautiful eyes, but I can get as close as I can with this tree here. Are you looking for something in color or green? You know, I try to add some flavor to the sales pitch. And then I get the closing thing. They'd be saying, oh, I don't know, $60 is like maybe a little bit more than I wanted to spend. And I said, well, either you're into Christmas or you're not. You know, I do a little
closing. That's a little guilt there.
You know, well, I try to add a little something there. You know, generally that's a good close though. You know what I'm saying?
I bet it works.
Because generally we do feel a little guilty about spending that type of money, but we realize it's for the kids, and the kids want everything they see. The sale with the parents with the two or three kids,
you're done.
They're leaving
you're
with
done.
Something. Yeah, you cook goose when you walk in with two or three kids.
Cool. Thanks very much.
Okay, Merry Christmas, you guys. Enjoy your tree.
Thank you.
And no matter what that tree say, keep it. They try to come back home sometime. With me, to make sure a person leave with the Christmas spirit is important. In the 7 years that we've been at this particular location, we've grown to know people personally. We're a big part of this community now. So it's a great pleasure to work here on this lot.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
One final note before we finish up today, Christmas gift lists. The New York Times has published the top trending gift searches on Google from cities around the country. There are a few things on there that lots of people seem to be hunting for. Toys from the movie Frozen, Legos, a very anti-holiday cheer game called Cards Against Humanity. And then there are some outliers, some weird ones. In Dallas, people are searching for Ouija boards. In Austin, kinetic sand. And in San Francisco, people are looking for wireless chargers and smartwatches. Of course they are. And that's our show for this Wednesday. The Dow rose 6 points, less than a 10%, to close at 18,030. The Nasdaq finished up 8 points, a 10%, to end at 4,773. And the S&P 500 traded flat at 2,081. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Phil Richards, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you on Christmas. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.